A week ago today, a frail-looking Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist administered the oath of office at President Bush's second inauguration. It was his first public appearance since he announced his fight with thyroid cancer last October. Despite his infirmities, the Chief Justice continues to participate in court deliberations, but his appearance last week did little to temper speculation that his departure as Chief Justice may come sooner rather than later. William Rehnquist has served on the court for about 35 years now and as Chief Justice for almost 20. In that time, the court and American politics have shifted considerably to the right. In a new book, constitutional law scholar Mark Tushnet argues that the court's most important ideological division is not between liberals and conservatives, but between two different kinds of conservatives. The result, he says, is a court friendly to economic conservatives, but not to social conservatives, or at least not yet. Later in the program, how new figures on fertility rates may affect the looming battle over Social Security, but first the Supreme Court. If you have questions about the issues and personalities that shape the Rehnquist Court and how that may affect the court to come, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Mark Tushnet is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center. His book is called A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law, and he joins us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you say the story of the Rehnquist Court is one of a divided court, but not that familiar division we hear of so much so often after court decisions between liberals and conservatives.
That's right. Of course, there are divisions between liberals and conservatives, but what drives the outcome is this division between two kinds of Republicans, what I call the modern Republicans or new breed Republicans, who are the heirs of the Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan tradition, Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Scalia, and Justice Thomas. And the others are traditional Republicans, used to be called Rockefeller Republicans or Northeastern Republicans. David Souter from New Hampshire is the most obvious example of that, but John Paul Stevens is, and in many ways, so is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and somewhat less so, Anthony Kennedy.
Well, let's get an idea of this division. Compare and contrast, if you will, Justice Kennedy and Antonin Scalia.
The primary division between the modern conservatives and the traditional ones is over these social issues. The traditional Republicans have a tolerance for diversity and an acceptance of sort of a noblesse oblige on the part of the better off. The more modern Republicans are committed to the social issue agenda of the conservative right in the Republican Party today.
Mm-hmm. Give us an example.
Well, the primary examples are gay rights and abortion. Justice Kennedy wrote a very expansive decision, striking down Texas's restriction or prohibition on homosexual sodomy. He described the relationships between homosexuals as intimate and having the same sort of deep characteristic as social relations or marital relations between heterosexuals. Justice Scalia wrote one of his usually bitter dissents, saying, well, this will put us on the road to all sorts of terrible things. That's one example. In the abortion area, Justices Souter, Kennedy, and O'Connor joined in an opinion upholding what they called the core holding of Roe and Wade, again provoking a quite bitter dissent from Justice Scalia, who thought that Roe and Wade had no basis in the Constitution at all.
So this idea then that, let me ask you about another idea that you also address in the book, and this is the idea of judicial activism supposedly abhorred by conservatives. Your argument is that all of the justices are activists.
Everybody is an activist on an issue that he or she cares a lot about. The term activism it turns out not to be terribly useful as a way of analyzing what happens. It started out as criticism of the Warren Court, and the word activism generally meant liberal activism. If you try to give it some more precise content like finding statutes unconstitutional on the basis of things that aren't clearly written into the Constitution. Well, it turns out that there are conservative activists who will do that too. Mm-hmm. Their issues are things like punitive damages, big business oriented things, protection of property against environmental regulation. So activism is something that happens on both sides of the spectrum.
So social conservatives would say there is no, the Constitution doesn't say anything about a right to privacy, so we have to be very cautious about this, and yet they might not be so cautious where it involved property rights.
That's right. It's exactly right. They say, look, what's wrong with activism is that it involves striking statutes down without anything in the Constitution saying you should do that. But when it comes to property rights, it turns out that the things they rely on to strike down legislation are just as unclear as the right to privacy is on the other side of the spectrum.
The central figure of your book is the Chief Justice. I mean, you write about all of them and how they arrived at the court and the various political machinations in some cases that went into their arrival there. But yet William Rehnquist seems to be the not only the presiding figure, but a central figure in the last, 30 years of American law.
The Chief Justice has been there for a long time. He was appointed by Richard Nixon in the first place to be a voice of conservatism. Nixon was told that William Rehnquist was the most conservative lawyer in the Justice Department. That was a real accomplishment under William Mitchell. Everybody knew what Rehnquist was going to be. His accomplishment has been to hang in there with his conservative views as more and more conservative justices joined the court, to the point where, although there hasn't yet been a conservative jurisprudential revolution, the possibility exists in a way that it did not exist even 20 years ago.
When you meet a revolution beyond these economic issues you talk about into the social issues.
That's right. The revolution, if it occurs, and there's no guarantee that it will, but if it occurs, it will involve overturning a set of commitments associated with the New Deal, which are mostly economic, the social safety net kinds mm-hmm. of ideas, and with the Great Society, which are civil rights ideas, the expansion of the idea of equality and so on. You can imagine, not that it will certainly happen, but a retrenchment on abortion rights, for example, more extensive restrictions on the ability of governments to protect civil rights in the name of religious freedom, for example. Things like that might happen in ways that wouldn't have been possible before Rehnquist arrived on the court.
Now, does this go back to a concept, at least on from some justices, of what's known as originalism? What is that?
Well, originalism is the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted only in light of what the words of the Constitution meant to the people who wrote them in 1789 or in 1868 when there were important amendments to the
Justice
Constitution.
Justice Scalia talks of this a lot.
Justice Scalia talks about this, although he calls himself a faint-hearted originalist. The problem is not with originalism as a theory, but with being consistent in it. It's one thing to say you'll only act on the basis of original understanding. It's another thing to actually do it. It turns out that of the people on the court who are originalists, Justice Thomas is the only one who's willing to say, look, in 1789, they really had a very limited understanding of what the national government could do, and we ought to go back to that. Nobody else, even Justice Scalia, is willing to say that.
We're talking with Mark Tushnet about his new book, which is A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Henry's with us from Muskogee, Oklahoma.
Yes, sir. I'd like to ask the guest, what does Bush mean by an activist judge? Or is it just one of his code words he uses all the time?
Well, the term activism is basically a term to criticize people on the other side of the political spectrum. So you have President Bush talking about activist judges, meaning liberal activists, and you have Senator Schumer talking about activist judges, meaning conservative activists. You actually have to attach the political or ideological label to the term activism before you can really know what people are talking about.
Does that answer your question, Henry?
No, it just makes it fuzzier, like the words the Constitution is written in. thanks for trying.
Well, thanks for the call, Henry. As we talk about that issue, obviously one of the things that I found most interesting about your book was the way that it tied the Supreme Court, which we think of as elevated above the day-to-day politics, how closely it is tied to national politics by the appointment process and by the confirmation process.
We have a system that we describe sometimes as separation of powers, where we think of the judges as independent, as you heard Chief Justice Rehnquist saying, but also as checks and balances. And one of the things we want to do is to have every branch checked and balanced by someone else. So the courts check Congress, but Congress and the president act to check and balance the court through the confirmation and nomination process.
And through this process, you tend to get a court that mirrors American politics.
As a general matter, political scientists have said for a long time that you're not going to find the court out of line with what's going on elsewhere in politics for very long. So for 20 years, we had divided government and we had a divided court. We may have a unified government now that will extend into the future, and the nomination and confirmation process will produce a court that, as I sometimes put it, will collaborate with what's happening in Congress and the presidency.
We're talking with Mark Tushnet. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the U.S. Supreme Court and how areas of law have changed under the Rehnquist Court. And, of course, we'll take more of your calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the Supreme Court with constitutional law scholar Mark Tushnet. His new book, A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And earlier, we were talking about your argument that there's really the most important ideological split on the court is between the two types of Republicans, rather than the conservative liberal approach that we so often hear about. But it's important to emphasize, you think there's only one true liberal on the court.
I think that's probably right. In some ways, actually, there are no traditional liberals at all. Nobody in the mold of Earl Warren or William Brennan or Thurgood Marshall. That's because liberalism and the Democratic Party have been transformed over the past 30 years as well. There's still a different kind of commitment to equality and racial justice on the liberal side and on the conservative side, but the differences are not nearly as dramatic as they would have been a generation ago.
And that one true liberal is?
My own view is that the true liberal, the leader, is John Paul Stevens on the liberal side, a Republican from Illinois, actually. But he's been shown some sort of remarkable skills in holding the liberal side of the court together. The others are Justices Souter, again, a Republican appointee, and Justices Breyer and Ginsburg, who were appointed by President Clinton.
You devote an entire chapter to Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I write about what I call Ruth Bader Ginsburg's Constitution and her Equal Protection Clause. Her entire career was, before coming to the court, was devoted to advancing the cause of women's rights. And in the chapter, I use a decision saying you couldn't have sex-segregated education at the Virginia Military Institute as a way of treating sort of that decision as the culmination of her career and the triumph of the vision about equality that she had been advancing throughout her life.
Let's get some more callers involved in the conversation, and we'll begin with Gordon. Gordon's calling from Tolleson, Arizona.
Yes, Hi. I've always felt that one problem with the original intent or strict constructionism argument is that it runs squarely against the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution, which I think was put in there precisely to prevent that kind of argument.
Well, the Ninth Amendment does say that the enumeration of rights in the Constitution shouldn't be construed by the judges to exclude other kinds of rights. And that does cut against the grain of original restricting interpretation simply to original understanding. Scholars of the Ninth Amendment have their very large controversies about what exactly it means. But its presence in the Constitution does at least suggest that it's all right for the judges to identify rights that aren't specifically listed in the Constitution.
Well, I agree there's a lot of controversy, but I think people should bear in mind that we only got the Constitution because there was an agreement to include a Bill of Rights, and we only got the Bill of Rights because there was an agreement to put the Ninth Amendment in so that no one could say, oh, these are the only rights you have. So in essence, the Bill of Rights was the price for the Constitution. The Ninth Amendment was the price for the Bill of Rights. I think the Ninth Amendment has not been given the respect that it deserves, in part because I think judges are afraid of exercising too much power on it, but I think perhaps we're swinging too far the other way and ignoring it completely.
Well, we'll accept your brief in the morning. Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you, and excellent book. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thanks very much. Let's talk now with Graham. Graham is calling from Davis, California.
Yes, hi. I'm a third-year law student and just had a question, comment regarding what I see as really rapid shifts with the Rehnquist Court towards, in my opinion, overvaluing or improperly balancing private property interests with less tangible interests, things like free speech, or public trust environmental interests. And I see in some ways the makings of a kind of judicially supported feudal state almost in terms of some of these shifts. And I'm wondering what comments the guest might have.
Well, I agree there's been that kind of transformation. I probably wouldn't describe it in quite those terms. But the Rehnquist Court, I certainly wouldn't think that it happened quite as rapidly as you suggest, but the Rehnquist Court has said that there are constitutional protections of property rights that do limit the ability of governments to regulate private property in the service of environmental protection. Its decisions so far have not been terribly extensive, but as I put it in the book, they've sort of opened the door to more extensive restrictions on government power. It'll be up to the justices who take office over the next few years to decide whether they want to walk through the doors that are now open.
Mm-hmm. Graham, if you cite us, we expect the full footnote.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I will read the book. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Graham.
Take care.
Is there one issue, do you think, that will characterize, as we look back on it, and the Rehnquist Court is not over by any means, but if we look back on it, assuming it had stopped today, that characterizes the Rehnquist Court?
The one issue that scholars, I think, look at is what people typically describe as the federalism revolution. In this context, what that means is the adoption of restrictions on the power of the national government so that states can do what they want free of national supervision. Now, much of that is quite technical, and again, what the Rehnquist Court has done is, in specific cases, not all that extensive. But until 1995, it had been 50 years or more before the court had limited national power, and everybody sort of assumed that Congress could do whatever it wanted. Now we know from the Rehnquist Court that there are some limits. We're not entirely sure what those limits are, but they could end up being quite substantial, particularly in the areas of environmental protection. And we'll find out over the next decades.
Yep, the Endangered Species Act is what...
Right. The hook for the Endangered Species Act is a provision that says Congress can regulate commerce among the several states. Now, many of these endangered species just sit in a particular state. I mean, they're nice there, but they don't travel across state lines. And so there's an argument that Congress doesn't have have the power to tell cities, look, you can't build, or developers, you can't build a development here because it's going to destroy the habitat of this local species.
A federally protected species.
Federal.
One thing you conclude is that there is a sense of disdain for Congress in the Rehnquist Court.
It's certainly true that in many of the court's federalism decisions and in some others, the majority seems to think that Congress doesn't pay attention to the Constitution, doesn't think seriously about what it's doing. The senators are just grandstanding for the public and don't really care about good public or constitutional policy.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation, and Paul is with us from Buffalo, New York.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
My question to you is, with the Rehnquist leaving and the Rehnquist Court going to be, you know, sitting there with obviously a vacancy, how does that affect, you know, people who are against the pro-life stand?
The impending Rehnquist resignation, I mean, everybody's assuming it's going to happen relatively soon. Nobody knows exactly when, but that resignation actually probably isn't going to change very much on the court. The reason is that the Chief Justice is one of these modern Republicans that I've described. President Bush is going to try to nominate another modern Republican. So all that you'll get is the sort of same political or ideological coloration in a somewhat younger person.
But what about the scenario where it is Mr. Scalia who is nominated to replace Mr. Rehnquist, and then you're having a new appointment to replace Mr. Scalia? Same thing, one for one?
Yeah, it would still be one for one. As a political matter, I think it would be dangerous for the president to try to pull that off, although it's possible. Justice Scalia is a divisive figure within the court, not just for the Democrats in the Senate. And I think the justices would let President Bush know that they didn't think that was a very good idea.
Paul, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
One of the interesting things about your book is the extent, which I hadn't realized, to which Mr. Rehnquist is revered by his fellow justices, in part because of whom he took over after, but also the way he runs the court.
The Chief Justice became Chief Justice after Warren Burger retired. Warren Burger was, by all accounts of the justices, really a terrible administrator of the court. And what Rehnquist does and has done is been to get the court to run effectively. Now, it's a job. And, you know, when you're working on a job, you want your working conditions to be good ones. Rehnquist has been absolutely superb at that from the point of view of the justices. Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall, who are both on the other side of the political spectrum, both called Rehnquist a great Chief Justice. And it was because he sort of transformed the court from a place where it was very uncomfortable, hard to get along with people, into a place where they sort of do get along with each other, notwithstanding their divisions.
Mm-hmm. Email question from Liam. He's read that Clarence Thomas does not really ask questions from the bench. Is that true?
Justice Thomas doesn't ask questions from the bench. It's given him a sort of an unfair public reputation as not engaged in the work of the court. Inside the court, he is extremely well respected. Justice Breyer has expressed his admiration for Justice Thomas's legal ability in complex statutory cases. And I have to say, Justice Thomas is, from my point of view, this is as an academic, I think, probably the most interesting of the justices, even though I disagree with him. He's got a distinctive constitutional vision different from anybody else on the court.
That's interesting, often described as a Scalia clone.
Well, he certainly isn't that. He is, as I said earlier, a much more consistent, original understanding person. He's written opinions that would really quite substantially limit the power of the national government in very dramatic ways, based on original understanding. And it sort of poses for all the justices and for the public whether we really want an original understanding interpretation of the Constitution.
One thing you write about him that defines his attitudes is that he is opposed to anything that smacks of patronage.
Well, he in the affirmative action cases of a couple of years ago, he said, I think fairly accurately, that one of the problems with affirmative action is that anybody who is in a position, any racial minority who's in an important position is tainted with the thought that the person doesn't really deserve it, but only got it because of affirmative action. He's clearly referring to himself, and with respect to himself, it's probably accurate. The public view of his accomplishments is lower than it ought to be.
Mark Tushnet is the author of A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Sierra. Sierra's calling from Tallahassee.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to what the caller said about the Ninth Amendment, and that reminded me, and this kind of makes me a geek, but there was a West Wing episode in which they quoted a Georgia delegate as saying something like, if we make a Bill of Rights, then some idiot in the future will think that those are the only rights. And I was wondering, do the judges take into consideration other writings by the founders other than just, you know, the straight laws, the Constitution, when they're taking into consideration what the founders meant?
The Federalist Papers, for example.
Sure. They quote the Federalist Papers a lot, and on occasion they will go into the documents like the one that you're citing, the debates at the conventions ratifying the Constitution in the states and so on. But they're not really historians, and they sort of mine these materials for nuggets that will be useful for the positions that they support, mostly for other reasons.
So this is, but they don't take it as holy writ the way they might take the Constitution.
I'm not clear that they take the Constitution as holy writ either. They're engaged in a job of interpreting the text in light of its understanding, what people understood it to mean at the time, and how it's developed over the past 200 years.
Sierra, thanks very much for the phone call, and good luck with all of those kids.
Yes, thank you.
are they all yours?
No, I'm at a playground. Only two of them are mine.
Okay, well, keep an eye on them.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks very much for the phone call. The reference to the West Wing brings to mind another interesting part of your book. We lay people don't hear about the court correctly, you think. We're subject to soundbite and cheerleading.
I think a lot of the public commentary is not as fully informed as I, at least, again, as an academic, would like it to be. What the court and the justices are doing is a sort of complicated legal/political enterprise. And I've fallen into just calling it liberal and conservative now. That's not really accurate. They're trying to interpret the Constitution as best they can by their own lights. That's a technical, sometimes technical and difficult job. Condensing what they're doing into Roe and Wade was upheld, or we should overrule Roe and Wade, distorts our understanding of what the judges do.
What's your responsibility, you as representative of the academics who are often called by people like us to say, what do we make of today's decision?
Well, unfortunately, I think our job is to indicate how it's a little more complicated than the ordinary public response would be.
It's not necessarily the answer we want to
hear. No, it's difficult to get the complexity across in a way that is not confusing to people who aren't embedded in constitutional law.
In recent cases, I guess going back to Bush v. Gore, that the court has made available audio tapes of arguments. Do you think this is a positive development? Do you get more understanding of what their procedure is like and what they're actually talking about?
It's certainly helpful to have these audio tapes available. And as I understand it, that program is accelerating so that relatively soon the audio tapes will be available basically, I think, on the same day, not simultaneously, but within
hours. They're now available within a few hours,
yes,
in certain select cases.
Yes. Well, I think they're about to do it pretty much as a routine matter. What they're not going to do is televise the oral arguments. Justice Souter, who's sort of representative of their views on this, has said that it's not going to happen while he's on the court, which will be a long time, I think. They like their privacy, and I'm not sure. Frankly, most oral arguments are pretty boring. If you try to listen to those tapes, you'll nod off fairly often because they're technical. They're not debates in Congress. They're arguments about what the Constitution means.
Though all journalists stand together, of course, on every question. On this one, we radio people would just assume all those tapes are kept out of the hands of those awful people at television. Mark Tushnet, stay with us. We have a couple more calls for you after we return from the break. We'll also be talking about a new report on birth rates around the world and why some countries are having fewer babies, why some are having more, and how all of that affects public policy. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking with Mark Tushnet. He's a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center and author of the newly published A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. And let's get a couple of other callers on the line. And let's begin with Rick. Rick's with us from Shaker Heights in Cleveland, in Ohio, near Cleveland.
Yes. My comment is the far right tends to bring up the term the founding fathers very often, and I really get tired of that. These gentlemen were not, you know, gods up on Mount Olympus. They were human beings. They were very flawed in some ways. They were not reflective of the average person. They were the wealthiest people in the country. And I would like to see that term disappear.
Founding fathers.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I should say, when I teach constitutional law, I, over the past few years, have been struck by the readiness of particularly women to observe that founding fathers has a sexist connotation to them. I end up defending them by saying, well, sure, they weren't perfect, but the line I use is James Madison was a smart guy and knew how to design a government pretty well.
But, Rick, you think it's being used for political purposes?
Yes, it's being used for political purposes.
Well, I think that's right. It's tied to this notion of original understanding, which has been used mostly by conservatives to restrict the development of more expansive, as they see it, liberal visions of equality and rights.
Well, one of the nice things about, and Rick, by the way, thanks very much for the call. One of the nice things about the book is it gives us a chance to see these people as individuals. You know, but personalities play a role in all of this dynamic as well. Obviously, you don't go, you know, hugely into, it's not a gossip book, but about their personalities and how they affect their decisions. And to see how the justices themselves are not exactly, well, James Madison reborn either.
Well, they're people like all the rest of us. They have friends and they have dislikes. Justice O'Connor has said that she doesn't think that, she said at one point at least, that she didn't think that Justice Scalia was, in her terms, a very polite man. Justice Scalia, who's a conservative, is very friendly with the liberal Justice Ginsburg, mostly because I think they're both people from sort of ethnic New York and extremely devoted to their families. These things have minor effects on how the court operates. Mostly the justices are trying to figure out what they think the Constitution should mean.
Here's an email question from Dave Moley in Minneapolis. Two questions for a layperson with only a basic understanding of the history of the court. First, what have been the most significant events or periods in the history of the Supreme Court, such as the Marshall Court, the Roosevelt Revolution, the Warren Court? Second, how does the Rehnquist Court compare?
Well, the emailer identified the three really major episodes in the court. The Marshall Court, which was the first shaping court for the Supreme Court. Constitutional amendments after the 14th Amendment, after the Civil War, transformed some aspects of our system. The New Deal Revolution occurred both in Congress and on the court. And then there was the Warren Court, which was the articulator of a new vision of equality and fairness. The Rehnquist Court, I think, may well stack up as one of those great courts because it has made possible a constitutional transformation of the sort that occurred under Earl Warren, obviously moving in a different direction, but possibly of equal significance.
And that might be, in fact, reversing a lot of the effects of the Roosevelt Revolution.
One of the possibilities is to undo the constitutional accomplishments of the New Deal, to restrict the power of the national government to regulate the economy, to take the government out of the business of supporting the needy. And things like that. Yes, those are now possibilities.
Let's get one final caller in, and this is Renee, who joins us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hello, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
Does your book address the issue of mandatory retirement for Supreme Court justices? And if not, do you see that being a policy that might take place in the future?
The book doesn't talk about it. I have views about it, which I'll express. The Constitution makes enacting mandatory retirement impossible. We could amend the Constitution, but our Constitution's very hard to amend. There's a proposal circulating on Capitol Hill now, which I've endorsed, that would have the effect of giving a very strong encouragement for justices to serve only 18 years. I think that's a good idea. I think 18 years is sort of the historical average. It's crept up over the past decades because of improvements in medical care. I think it would be a good idea to have justices who are more regularly sort of in touch with the trends in the society.
I completely agree with you. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Renee. And David, Mark Tushnet, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Mark Tushnet, professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center. His book, A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law, and he joined us here in Studio 3A.